Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Britain after Brexit. And Richard, for years now, we have been dealing with the fallout from Brexit, the United Kingdom's exit from the European Union. We are now more than 3 years, as well as three prime ministers, removed from the vote. And the newest resident of 10 Downing Street, Boris Johnson, is now moving in what could certainly be called a bold fashion, whether you like it or not. What he's been doing has been widely referred to as suspending Parliament, which gives it a slightly more exotic connotation than is probably justified. What he's essentially doing is starting the new session considerably later than normal. So it's a very small window for people who are opponents of what's called a no-deal Brexit. That is, the UK leaving the EU without having to come to mutual agreement on the terms gives them less time to delay or prevent the UK's departure. Okay, so that's where we are now. Order of operations here. Let's go back to the start and work through this. So first off, Richard, how do you think about the cost-benefit analysis for Britain of being an EU member state? Which way would you have been inclined to vote had you been a Brit?
Well, I made several articles on this on the Defining Ideas column in 2016 when it happened, and I described myself as somebody who was a cautious Brexiteer. And the reason I was a Brexiteer is I thought that there were two things that were essentially intolerable about the European Union. One was the massive bureaucracy in Belgium and in Brussels, which essentially stifled any kind of collective innovation and imposed all sorts of very heavy rules on issues like labor and so forth. The EU became a statist operation under Brussels, and I think the British were right to chafe under it. And the other thing, of course, is if you're in the EU, you get a free trade zone on one dimension, but it turns out you don't get free trade with anybody outside the Union. It's kind of like a huge tariff wall outside the EU and relatively free trade within it. And the British had perfectly sensible reasons for saying that, you know, they would like to have free trade with the Commonwealth and the United States and all the rest of that stuff. The reason why I was a cautious Brexiteer was I had no idea whether or not they would be able to negotiate a second sensible deal. I will tell just a little anecdote. As this was going on, we had several panels at the NYU Law School, and there was one which featured two genuine heavyweights, Joseph Weiler, and the other was Lord Mervyn King, and they were talking about it, and Mervyn was a Brexiter, and Joe was not, and they sat around, and they said, well, what are you going to do? And you listen to them talk, and they said, well, this is the way in which it has to go. We create a free trade zone. What we do is we allow the movement of capital, we allow the movement of services, and the movement of labor on short-term issues. But what we don't do is have the resident rights, and we kind of treat Brexit as a second-tier kind of a relationship, much like the one that the EU has with Norway. And they kind of looked at each other and said, kind of easy now, isn't it? Well, it went anything like that when it came to the real relationship. And I think there were basically two culprits in this. One was Angela Merkel, who was basically an EU forever type woman, and she didn't want to have any kind of compromise whatsoever, stiff exit fees and the like. And then there was the thoroughly well-meaning but completely inept Theresa May, and the two of them managed to make a complete mess out of this thing. May essentially frittered away her majority in Parliament by calling for a snap election, and what she found out is that if you have no program to offer the electorate, then it turns out you get no electoral support, and the Conservative majority shrunk in consequence, which reduced her bargaining freedom very considerably. There was adamance on the other side, lots of fighting over how many billions of dollars the British would have to pay in order to leave. I wasn't even sure which way the money ought to run, so complicated are those issues. And the thing got completely bogged down, and now what we do is we have Mr. Boris Johnson in charge of this situation, and he's a no-deal exit kind of guy. We don't know whether it's bluster or whether it's true. We do know he has put together an October 31st deadline for deal or no deal, but we're gone type situation. So the situation is fraught at this particular point in time. And I mean, I went back and I read several British commentaries on this situation, and I was extremely pleased to find one thing. Nobody has any better idea of what's going to happen than I do. So this is not a case where being an insider gives you an edge up on the information gate. This is a case where being an insider lets you know all the complexity, so you're more confused than the outsiders who mercifully, you know, spared all all the details of the infighting that's going on. You looked at a list of famous lords and ladies on the Conservative Party who've taken one side or another, never heard of him. So, hey, that's a great thing. I have heard of Mr. Corbyn, and, of course, the Conservatives and everybody else are frightened to death that that man would go into power. He's probably anti-Semitic, and he's certainly a kind of a big-time socialist. It would completely wreck arrangements with respect to the United States and so forth. So there's so many caroms in this particular billiard game that we have no idea whether or not these balls are going to connect or whether they're going to go sadly astray.
Let me talk to you about one of those complications. I want to ask you about the mechanism here, because British citizens voted to exit the EU via referendum, and they had a binary choice, leave or remain. And, of course, the reality of the situation is a little more complicated than that, because you're just willing the ends and not the means, and there's a wide universe, as we're seeing, of conditions under which a country could leave or remain. So in the voting at the time, there was a majority for leave, but certainly not a sweeping mandate. It won 52-48. Public opinion, best we can tell, hasn't radically changed since then, though there has been some polling to suggest it's maybe vacillated a bit. And there's been a good bit of talk over the past few years over whether, for instance, a referendum should be held. So bottom line, this is messy. Is that all worth it to have the decision made directly by the British people, or would they have been better off handling this outside the referendum process?
Well, nobody really knows, because essentially there was no particular authorization to do this by referendum. And after the referendum, there was this huge legal battle as to whether or not the referendum was conclusive on the parliament or whether or not it had to be enacted into law in some particular way. I believe that the issue went up to the House of Lords, and they decided that you had to have some kind of ratification. The arguments are completely obscure to me, and I think to everybody else. It's a one-time wonder, and they then got the ratification that was needed. But, you know, it wasn't clear that people voted their conscience. Half of the people said, well, we have to do this because the referendum is really powerful, and other people said we're doing it because we believe it on the merits. So after that particular situation, the legitimacy crisis became every bit as acute. The Remainers, many of whom were in the financial industry inside London proper, said, well, it was only 52-48, when it take all past the post, we shouldn't do something like that on a matter this big. I happen to think structurally that they're correct. I don't think a 52-48 majority is enough to have a huge upheaval. I would think this was a case where you'd want a supermajority vote, say of 60%, at which point the Remainers win, even if I might have voted in the opposite direction. But there's no precedent whatsoever for having a second referendum if it turns out that the first referendum was said to be the one-all, be-all, and end-all of this entire situation. So what happens is there's so many disagreements with respect to the choice of means and with respect to the desirable ends that it's very difficult to figure out how you could put together any kind of a winning coalition on the conservative side. And the EU has basically decided to remain very tough with respect to this. And I think the reason that they've done so is if you could get Brexit, you could get Frexit, and then you could get Grexit, and then you could get any other exit that you want to talk about, and the whole thing will fall apart. My view is, let's have that happen. As I said early on, I think the terrible mistake was the one that they made when they decided to move from a free trade zone into a kind of dual sovereignty American-like federalist system. Free trade is relatively easy. You knock down barriers and you let each country decide how it's going to run its own internal affairs. And the protections that are given to outsiders are basically non-discrimination rules. So if it turns out that you have a law that provides minimum wages that are going to have to be paid to British workers by British firms, foreign firms want to do business in England, they're going to have to say the same thing with labor unions and everything else. So the non-discrimination principle has the following real virtue. If Britain decides to have one type of minimum wage law and France another and Italy a third, you don't have to get them all to agree. All you have to do is to get each one to agree to apply its own rule with respect to all of its people who are inside their own country and who come in from overseas. At that particular point, there is going to be a real attractive movement in order to have deregulation, because it's an exit game. And if the British have a more attractive system for work, then people will start to move over in that direction, leaving France. And indeed, there was an old joke, I think it was told to me by Mervyn King, you know, my source on all of these kinds of issues. It says, all the Englishmen go to France to retire, and all the Frenchmen come to England to work. And I think that it's a nice line, and I think there's a great deal of truth to the way in which you want to put that thing together. But I regard that as a very powerful system. But just as in the United States, when you start getting federal law, you can really ratchet up the regulation because you reduce the exit rights. So the same thing happened with respect to what went on in the European Union. And the joke was that all of the defeated labor MPs decided to go work in Brussels so that they could impose their labor regulations through the center and put it back with respect to Parliament. So I think that the whole situation was a complete disaster, and that Brexit was actually, it should have been the start of a land run. But there are many people who believe that it's not. To give you another illustration where I think the British were right, you can't have a uniform currency if you don't have a single government that is going to be in charge of the fiscal policy as well. And so all of the great complications that arose for several years when there was the Greek crisis and the Italian crisis and the Portuguese and the Spanish crisis came because the strong currency worked for Germany, but it didn't work for Greece. Britain stayed out of the monetary union. It still trades on the pound. And it's been an enormous advantage for the way in which it starts to work. If you want to have a unified currency, what you have to do is to have a very strong centralized government with budgetary responsibilities. And of course, you don't have that with respect to the peculiar form of federalism that takes place in there. So what Brexit did was expose the huge structural deformities and infirmities with respect to the way in which the EU was organized. Now, why is it that they made these kinds of mistakes? Well, you have to understand the kinds of people who run the European system. There are very few laissez-faire capitalist types amongst them. Most of them are some kind of democratic socialist. They're by no means totalitarian. They're by no means strongly anti-market to the extent that they want to wipe it out. But if you're trying to figure out where the needle is going to go, they're going to have a heavier hand of regulation than the Brits generally wanted, and a heavier hand than we have in the United States. I just mentioned one thing which I think is very instructive. There is no new generation tech firm which has ever been started in the EU. Any firm that starts to die, because the whole labor structure and the capital structure and everything else there makes it impossible to start. So they all start in America, and then when they go over into the EU, you could always see the welcome stranger stuff, and then all of a sudden you get heavy taxes and tariffs, and then you get the American companies trying to play fast and loose with the tax law. This would be a much better world if, in fact, you had less repressive legislation on the continental side, so you can actually start up some serious major competitors to the American firms. It will not happen so long as Brussels runs the roost. Those people have no idea of what a deadening form they are with respect to new innovation. And what you always say to people who are in favor of regulation, you can't regulate firms that won't form, and that's exactly what you have in Europe. You can't drive out of businesses that never start.
Richard, the Speaker of the House of Commons referred to Boris Johnson's decision to shorten the time that Parliament has to debate Brexit as a, quote, constitutional outrage. Now, as some of our listeners may know, that means something slightly different to Brits than it does to Americans, because the British have an unwritten constitution, which may sound like an oxymoron to American ears. Can you explain for us what that means and whether, in your opinion, Prime Minister Johnson really is a threat to it?
Well, I mean, we also have an unwritten constitution in the United States that operates side by side with our written constitution. We could talk about that in a second. But essentially, you remember, I was trained in the English legal system before I came to America. And basically, all of the central rules came place through conflict resolution, changes in custom and usage. And so what you saw was this move from a very heavy monarchy with a dominant king to a strong House of Lords and a rather weak commons, to the situation now where the House of Lords is kind of dicey, where the king and queen have no role. The prime minister is almost invariably, I guess since Lord Salisbury at the end of the 19th century, is always drawn from the commons. And they have certain conventions as to when they have votes of confidence, how they form cabinets, what takes like with back benches and the like. And there's something known as proroguing Parliament, means delaying the start. And you're always allowed to delay a little bit. Essentially, I think the convention was that the time of starting was not supposed to be changed for purely political reasons, but because, you know, there's a hurricane or there was some immediate crisis that you had to deal with that made it difficult to assemble everybody. And here it's overtly political. So the guys who are running the House of Commons are saying he's trying to rig the deck in order to make sure that he could stifle debate so as to make it easier for him to get his no-deal Brexit through. And they think that he's not only trying trying to pummel his conservative opponents and some of his labor opponents, but he's trying to do this in order to improve the bargaining leverage that it has with respect to the EU, because this is the kind of audacious move that Theresa May would never make even in her wildest moment. So I think there is something to this. Look, we have a similar situation in the United States. I mean, we have this very powerful rule which says that the Senate can confirm or not confirm presidential nominees to the courts for good reason, no reason, or bad reason. And yet, until about the year 2000, you never had anything remotely like what you saw with respect to Kavanaugh. Check that. It started with Bork. It continued with respect to Thomas. It went into abatement a little bit during the Clinton years. And I think even the Alito and Roberts nominations were relatively civil. But, you know, when it starts coming up today, a completely different set of expectations about this. And it turns out that, you know, it may well be that the American constitutional structure, which depends hugely on all sorts of informal conventions, is going to be battered very heavily. So I think, in effect, that no constitutional structure is impervious with respect to exogenous shocks. And that's exactly what you have with respect to Brexit. I mean, we ran a conference at the Classical Liberal Institute in New York City to talk about this, and we had half Remainers and half Brexiteers and so forth. And, you know, they were certainly, shall we say, not entirely in agreement with one another, and there were some epic debates that you had. But there were other people there who did something else. They said, well, you know, we've got these complicated patent conventions and copyright rules and intellectual property rules of other sorts. And it turns out that we have banking regulations and insurance regulations and so forth. And all of these things are going to be an untangled mess. And unless you have some real strong leadership, they're going to break down. And that's the problem that one had. And so when I said, I'm going to say, end where I began, I was dubious about Brexit, not because I didn't think that the end was right. I do think it was right. I still think it was right. But getting there was a high wire act. And it turned out, I would say, that the level of performance of all the key actors was much worse than anybody had a right to expect. I mean, oddly, an odd construction, to be sure. And so that's why we're in this terrible situation. And nobody seems to have an idea of how this thing will end. I don't think there'll be a war over this stuff, but I certainly do think that there could be some major disruptions in economic relationships going in unpredictable directions. And one has to be quite apprehensive about a situation, because there's nobody involved in this particular situation who seems to have enough intellectual clarity on the one hand and political support on the other to run this thing through to some kind of a successful conclusion.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.